What if everything we've always been told about federal deficits is wrong?
There is an important difference when it comes to understanding the government's budget and the government's finances as compared to all the rest of us. They can never run out of money. We can. They can never face bills coming due that they can't afford to pay. We can. They can spend money they do not have. We can't.
That's economist Stephanie Kelton. We spend the hour with her talking about her mind-blowing book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. We also have some summer reading picks that you can enjoy at the beach or poolside. Just remember to stay physically distanced and wear your mask when you can't. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. We've all heard it a million times. We can't have universal affordable health care because how are you going to pay for that? We can't have free public college because how are you going to pay for that? We can't increase Social Security because how are you going to pay for that? But when the pandemic happened and the Congress passed a $2 trillion aid package, we didn't hear those words. Nor did we hear them when Wall Street imploded in 2008 and the banks got a $1 trillion bailout. Nor do we ever hear those words when every single year the Congress passes a record-breaking military budget, $780 billion this year. Ever since Ronald Reagan, we've been told by Democrats and Republicans alike that the richest society in the world can't afford to take care of its citizens, that to do so would burden our descendants with crushing federal debt. But in the middle of a pandemic where the U.S. is throwing money around like candy, mostly to those who need it least, that excuse is wearing thin. Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, exposes the lie behind the "we can't pay for it" mantra. She writes, "Deficits can be used for good or evil. They can enrich a small segment of the population, driving income and wealth inequality to new heights, while leaving millions behind. They can fund unjust wars that destabilize the world and cost millions their lives. Or they can be used to sustain life and build a more just economy that works for the many and not just the few." Stephanie Kelton is a proponent of modern monetary theory, or MMT. With its new ways of understanding money, taxes, and the critical role of deficit spending, MMT redefines how to responsibly use our resources so that we can imagine a new politics and a new economy and move from a narrative of scarcity to one of opportunity. Kelton is a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University. She's former chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee, the Democratic staff. Stephanie Kelton, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, The Deficit Myth, blew my mind. First of all, just give us a quick definition of modern monetary theory, or MMT.
So I think the quick definition would be to say that MMT is about replacing an artificial budget constraint with a real resource constraint, with an inflation constraint. And what I mean is that we have a country here in the US that operates with what I will call a sovereign currency. The US government is the issuer of the US dollar. The rest of us, households and private businesses, even state and local governments, are what I will call users of the currency. So there is an important difference when it comes to understanding the government's budget and the government's finances as compared to all the rest of us. They can never run out of money. We can. They can never face bills coming due that they can't afford to pay. We can. They can spend money they do not have. We can't. And so, you know, I'm sure we'll talk more, but we're getting a pretty good look right now watching Congress pass trillions of dollars of spending bills in an economic environment where, you know, revenues are collapsing. And yet somehow Congress is still able to authorize trillions of dollars of new spending. So how come that's the case?
And we saw a little bit of that back in 2009 when the Obama administration came in on the heels of the Great Recession. Before that, in 2015, in 2015, you served as the chief economist for the Democrats on the U.S. Senate Committee on the Budget. Did they understand MMT?
You know, that's such an interesting question. I will say no, but there are parts of it that they must understand without knowing that they understand. So, for example, whenever the Defense Authorization Act comes up and it's time to reauthorize the budget for the Pentagon, somehow virtually every member of the Senate was able to walk in and vote to authorize spending without pausing for a moment to have a debate about where the money was going to come from, how are we going to find the money, do we have to raise taxes to pay for this. They just walk in every single year and vote to commit to spending hundreds of billions of dollars on defense. And so there's something inside of them that lets them know that they have this power. And as I said, you know, they're basically all doing it now because the coronavirus pandemic led Congress to act with a very real sense of urgency. And the House and the Senate got together, they authorized and committed to spending trillions of dollars to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and the ensuing economic meltdown. They didn't stop and have a debate about raising taxes or how to come up with the money to do this. They understand that Congress has the power of the purse. So, you know, it's a tough thing because, as I said, they sometimes get it, but then, you know, other times they have the seemingly endless debates over the deficit and balancing the budget and, you know, believing that they can't afford to put money into education or infrastructure because everything must be paid for.
Right. Everything must be paid for. This is a bipartisan thing, although perhaps we could argue that, you know, the idea that government can't pay for things, that government shouldn't run deficits, that government should have a balanced budget all the time, is not an idea that was always shared in the federal government. So is this part of a political program as opposed to an economic program?
Well, you're absolutely right. The very notion of a fiscal deficit has been highly politicized. It's like a political football that each of the two parties sort of use to their perceived advantage. So, you know, when the other party wants to do something that you don't support, you can attack them and say, this is irresponsible policy because you're adding to the deficit. So, for example, the Democrats in the fall of 2017 put up a fight against the Republicans who were on the verge of passing what is known as the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. Those were big tax cuts that the Republicans passed at the end of 2017. The Democrats said, we don't like this because you're going to add almost $2 trillion to deficits in the next couple of years. But if Democrats are in control or pushing for legislation that might also add to the deficit, but to do it in order to fund things like, I don't know, healthcare, education, infrastructure, Republicans can say, we don't like those. We don't like that legislation because it will add to the deficit. So both sides always historically have found ways to use the deficit as an excuse to oppose legislation or public or programs that they don't want to support. And the deficit becomes a very convenient foil.
So let's go back to the nuts and bolts of MMT, of modern monetary theory, in this first myth that you tackle, which is the idea that the government should budget like a household. You say that Uncle Sam will never go broke. You've told us, you know, the money is always going to be there. Why is that exactly? Explain to us why we can just issue this money into existence, and then tell us whether there are any constraints on doing something like that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, most people have no idea probably how the government actually spends. What we probably most of us believe is that the government goes out and gets the money. And they raise taxes, so they get money from people like us. We pay our taxes every year. That gives the government some money. And then if it comes up short, if it doesn't have enough tax revenue to cover all of its spending, then it goes out and borrows some additional money from people who have it, from savers, let's say. And that those are the two primary ways the government pays its bills, taxing and borrowing. In fact, and then I go through this in the book, that's not at all the way it works. So when you say, how does the government actually, you know, spend all of this money? How is it working? How does it happen? The answer is that Congress commits to a budget, that Congress authorizes some spending. So maybe the easiest way to see this is to just look at what's happened in the last few months. Mm-hmm. The House and the Senate passed four pieces of major legislation. The biggest one was called the CARES Act. The CARES Act was a $2.2 trillion spending bill authorized by Congress, signed by the President of the United States. I will say that the money to fund that spending came from the congressional authorization. Congress appropriates money, and it doesn't have to have the money in order to do that. What it does is commit to spending money it doesn't have. So then you say, okay, wait a minute. Once they commit to spending $2.2 trillion, where does the actual money come from? And the answer is that the federal government has a bank, and the federal government's bank is called the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve's job as the fiscal agent for our government is to carry out payments on behalf of the U.S. Treasury. If Congress authorizes some spending, the Treasury begins to spend, and the Fed's job is to carry out the payments. So effectively, that $2.2 trillion CARES Act was Congress ordering up $2.2 trillion from the Fed, and the Fed fills the order. And how does the Fed fill the order? Okay, this is going to surprise some people, but the truth is, the reality is, that the Federal Reserve fills the order by changing the numbers in appropriate bank accounts. They make somebody's bank account larger. How do they do that? They use nothing more than a computer keyboard. And so what's really happening is we're creating digital dollars. They are conjured into existence from a keyboard at the Federal Reserve Bank, and numbers are added to balance sheets as authorized by Congress. And that's how it works. It's not a proposal. MMT is not saying we could do it this way. MMT is describing the way the government already spends today. All government spending is financed with new money creation. There's no other way for it to work.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Stephanie Kelton about her book, The Deficit Myth: Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. It will completely change the way you think about spending, taxes, and the real choices we can make to create a better world for all. You know, I can hear the voices of the conservatives in the background saying that this is fiat money, as if there is something wrong, and it is fiat money, you're creating money by fiat, that there's something wrong with that, that we, you know, gold is the only real value. We went off the gold standard with Bretton Woods back in, was it the 1970s, that one, Nixon? So, isn't this a dangerous thing? Isn't, you know, I think that the idea that comes to mind is like, well, if you're just creating it out of thin air, then that's kind of magical thinking and very dangerous.
Well, I would suggest the alternative is true, that we would be in a world of hurt right now if we were on a gold standard. Why? Because a gold standard does not afford the kind of flexibility that governments need to respond quickly in times of crisis. Think about what we would have to do if Congress needed to hire a bunch of people to go dig holes in the ground and find gold in order to be able to support the economy in the face of a coronavirus pandemic. That would be a disaster, which is why, by the way, governments have always suspended or abandoned gold standards in moments of crisis. We got off the gold standard because we wanted to fight World War I and we needed the policy flexibility. So the US suspended the gold standard. We went back on the gold standard during what are known as the interwar years, the period between World War I and World War II. The gold standard came back, and then the U.S. decided it was going to enter World War II, and again, we go off the gold standard. So a gold standard is very constraining in terms of how it allows the government to operate its budget. So I think, like I said, we'd be in a world of hurt today if Congress didn't have the capacity to step up and do whatever it takes to support paychecks, to support small businesses, to support our economy through this very serious crisis. So gold standards have been tried and always abandoned when governments needed added policy space. I'm very, very glad that we are not constrained today by a monetary system from the sort of dark ages.
You attack the deficit myth on, I believe it's six different points. I'm going to jump to number three right now, because the question always comes up when you're talking about creating this kind of money, creating this kind of deficit, that our children are going to be paying off our debt. And, you know, I mean, I thought the same thing when they authorized the CARES Act. I said, oh, my God, what is this going to mean for my granddaughter?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you're certainly not alone in having those kinds of anxieties, because for so many years, this is the way the discourse has run, that, you know, our pundits and, you know, journalists, our politicians, the overwhelming majority of the information that we receive about our nation's fiscal finances is filtered through this sort of household lens, so that we end up, I think, getting a lot of things wrong and then creating a lot of unnecessary anxiety for people. And it's a shame, because there's plenty to worry about in the world today. You know, are our kids going to be able to safely return to school? Are our jobs going to be there, you know, 6 months from now? Are we going to be able to make a house payment or rent payment? Am I going to contract this, you know, dangerous virus? I mean, there's plenty to worry about. The last thing we need is to be, you know, piling on anxieties about things that aren't real threats. And this is one of those things, telling people that somehow, because the government is running deficits and increasing something we call the national debt, that we're all going to have to pay a huge price for this in the future, that we're burdening our children and our grandchildren. It's just simply not the case. We will be burdening our children and our grandchildren if we leave them with a planet that is, you know, increasingly inhospitable, uninhabitable, if we leave them with infrastructure that continues to crumble, if we leave them with student loan debt and colleges and universities that are either disappearing or, you know, out of reach, but for all but an elite few. I mean, there are plenty of ways to burden future generations, but the national debt is nothing more than a historical record of all of the past instances where the government added more dollars to the economy than it subtracted away. Those dollars are being held in the form of something called a government bond, US government securities, and that's all it is. But we've attached this label called the national debt to that historical record, and that creates a lot of confusion and unnecessary anxiety.
Yeah, I think that people think that we're going to be paying interest on that. In other words, you often hear we're going to be paying interest on that debt. Just like if I go to the bank and I borrow a mortgage, if I keep on taking out second and third mortgages, I'm adding to the interest that I'm paying on that debt. Why is it that this In other words, what is the relationship between the national debt and the real economy? Why can we think about it maybe more as an investment than a loan? How can we ensure that it doesn't spiral out of control with the need to service a national debt with ever-increasing interest payments?
Well, okay, so there's a lot there that we would have to unpack first. I think it's really important to remember that the federal government, because it is the issuer of the dollar, never needs to borrow a single dollar from anybody in order to spend. If you were the issuer of the currency, you wouldn't say, I have to go out and borrow dollars in order to cover the bills. No, it doesn't have to do that at all. So if there is anxiety about this thing we call the national debt, and the fact that it is interest bearing, we do pay interest on those bonds, then one answer would be just don't issue it anymore. If you don't like it and you don't want to pay interest to bondholders, just stop doing it. Okay, because there is something that resonates with me when we talk about bondholders receiving interest for holding a government security, a bond that doesn't require them to take any risk. You're supposed to get interest. Interest is the reward, and there's supposed to be a risk-reward trade-off. In other words, when you part with cash and lend money to someone and there's risk involved, the interest rate is your reward for taking on that risk. But there's no risk associated with holding government bonds. You're just getting pure reward. So then we have to ask, why does the government choose to give some people government bonds, to sell government bonds in exchange for its currency, when what's happening is the government is turning plain old regular dollars into dollars that pay interest? That's what government bonds are. They're dollars that pay interest. So it's a pretty good deal for people who are well off enough that they can afford to save some of their money and then park those dollars in the form of a very safe, interest-bearing asset and just sit back and collect the interest. Okay, so that's one part of the answer. The other part is that you are right. There is a lot of anxiety about the interest on the debt because, like you said, people think of it as going and borrowing money from a bank and having to pay interest. So they start internalizing what's happening through the filter of their own personal finances. And that always leads to problems. So, you know, it also happens in Congress because when I worked in the Senate, I can tell you that Democrats and Republicans, senators from both sides of the aisle, are really anxious about interest on the national debt. They see the interest on the national debt as money that's being spent that could have been spent in a different way. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. So like Congress says, okay, why are we spending $385 billion a year on interest? That's $385 billion a year we could be spending on education or infrastructure or something else. To which I say, well, you could always spend more on infrastructure or education or whatever else. You're Congress. You write the budget. So if you pass a bill and you want to put more money into some other line item of the budget, you have the power to do that. The fact that you're paying hundreds of billions of dollars out in interest doesn't limit your ability to commit to spending more on other priorities. It's not a zero-sum game.
Right. And I think that that's really the key phrase. It's not a zero sum game in the case of the federal government, but it is when it comes to state and local governments who are absolutely being hammered here. If those senators and congressmen and you advise Senator Bernie Sanders, and he's one of those who's worried about the interest, coming due for our grandchildren as well. So it's really bipartisan. But if you were advising them right now, what would be the MMT solution to the state and local governments? I mean, should they should they be bailed out? Are there some other ways? Should they be issuing currencies of their own?
Well, they shouldn't have to consider that, right? We are the United States of America. We have a currency union and we have a currency issuer. And the currency issuer is the federal government. And you are absolutely right. They are being hammered. State and local governments all across the country. Governors from Gavin Newsom in California all the way through to Governor Cuomo in New York and everywhere in between. You've got mayors and governors who are pleading with the federal government to get them help, because their budgets are absolutely getting hammered. Because when the economy turns down, they lose massive amounts of revenue. And they're not currency issuers. They are revenue constrained. They need tax dollars in order to be able to cover the bills. So they're pointing the finger at the currency issuer, at the federal government. And they're saying, you're in a unique position. You can help. And that's exactly what I would be advising, and what I have been advising, in fact, because I am fortunate enough to be in conversations with members of the House and the Senate still, even though I'm no longer working in the Senate. And I think, you know, Democrats understand this very clearly, that the federal government needs to act. There is money in the HEROES Act. The House has already passed that bill. They want to get money to state and local governments. It has to happen. You know that it's Mitch McConnell and most Republicans who are standing in the way of getting that much needed aid to state and local governments. So it's got to happen. I don't know how much further they're going to push state and local governments to the brink, but already we've seen more than 1.5 million job losses at the state and local level. Public sector jobs disappearing. The Economic Policy Institute, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C., they put out a report. They estimated that something like 5.2 million more jobs are at risk if state and local governments don't get financial assistance. So I don't even call it a bailout. You know, a bailout is sort of something you do when somebody's behaved badly, you know, and you go rescue them, you bail them out of trouble. This is through no fault of their own that state and local government budgets are imploding. So you just have to get them assistance.
Yes. And of course, this is at a time when President Trump is trying to bully states into fully opening their schools, you know, aside from even the infection risk. And there are very good reasons to open the schools, but they're going to need a lot of money in order to open the schools safely. And that's money that comes out of local and state budgets.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can listen to almost any superintendent in this country, and they will tell you exactly what you just said, that if you want us to open, and we recognize the only way we can open and bring teachers and students and staff back in is if we can do it safely. And doing it safely means following CDC guidelines. And to follow CDC guidelines, we're going to need a lot of money, because we're going to have to, you know, double up our custodial staff. We are going to have, you know, hand washing and sanitizing stations and social distancing measures and all the rest of it. And unless you're prepared to help us, you know, shoulder that financial burden, what it's going to take to do that, then, you know, you're effectively giving us an unfunded mandate. We cannot do it. And they're right.
Economist Stephanie Kelton. We'll talk more about her book, The Deficit Myth, after the break. Don't go away.
Now, we spent $6 trillion in Iraq while cutting that corporate tax. I didn't hear anyone say, how you gonna pay for that? $693 billion on Trump's military budget. Silence from the talking heads. How you gonna pay for that? Have more than the poorest half, but health insurance for everybody
How Are You Gonna Pay for That? By Jonathan Mann. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast. It's free, and newsletter, that's free too, at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Let's get back to my conversation with economist Stephanie Kelton about her groundbreaking book, The Deficit Myth. It uses MMT, or modern monetary theory, to explode the myth that deficits are bad, and it lights the path to using our resources wisely to invest in our well-being and our future. You're not saying that we can spend and spend all we want. So what are the constraints on expenditures? What is the link to the real economy of, you know, the money, our monetary system?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I am not saying that we can spend without limit. I am saying, and MMT is saying, that we've been paying attention to the wrong limits. We've been worrying about artificial limits. We should have been worried about real limits. The real limits are in our real economy, in our economy's people, our productive resources, our raw materials, our machines, our factories, our technological know-how. Those are our real resources. And with those real resources, we are capable of producing a lot, right? We have an economy that is a $23, $24 trillion economy. So the resource constraints are real. You can't demand more of an economy than an economy is capable of producing. So could you try to spend too much money? Could Congress authorize too many spending bills and outstrip our economy's real productive capacity? Yes, it could. It could push the economy above what it's capable of producing. And the punishment for doing that would be inflation. So if you go back to a historical example, you think about World War II, that was a time when the federal government was acting with a sense of urgency, right? A wartime economy, ramping up government spending on an unprecedented scale. Okay, we took government spending to almost 50% of total US GDP. So half of every dollar spent in the economy, roughly, was federal government spending. So that happened very, very quickly. And it did lead to some inflationary pressures because we were running a wartime economy. Women entered the workforce in, you know, unprecedented numbers. Workers were working double and triple overtime. And there was some inflationary pressure. But we managed it, or they managed it, really, really well. So yes, you pushed inflation up to 4.5, 5.5, 6 or 7% in a year or two, but that wasn't so bad because you were fighting a world war and you came out victorious on the other side. And then you ushered in the longest period of peacetime prosperity, built the middle class, right? Inequality shrunk over that period. Workers' wages were very high. These became known as the golden age of capitalism. So even though we pushed beyond our limits then, we still ended up much, much better off as a society and as an economy in the years that followed. So the situation is very different today. We are nowhere near pushing up against the limits. We have tens of millions of people unemployed today. We don't have workers on double and triple overtime. We have unemployment rates that are well into the double digits right now. We have factories and industries, entire industries that would be desperate for customers if it was safe for people to go into restaurants and bars and movie theaters and hotels and all the rest of it. So we have ample productive capacity to safely handle the spending that Congress has authorized. We're not anywhere close to pushing up against our capacity constraints today.
Yeah, you know, the European nations, we know that they have, in fact, just replaced the wages, allowed people to stay on the payroll and actually paid for the payroll of these private governments, of these private companies. But beyond the pandemic, you talk about, you know, let's talk a little bit about the people's economy now, because you say we could actually guarantee a job to everyone, a federal jobs guarantee. You call it a public option for employment. Tell us how that would work and why it would be a good idea to do that, even beyond the COVID pandemic.
Well, sure. I do want to recognize that we did try to do, and to some extent did do, what some of the European countries have done in terms of payroll protection and government stepping in and backstopping payrolls and trying to keep workers attached to their employer and on payroll. We didn't execute it as well as some European countries because we didn't have that infrastructure in place the way a country like Germany, for example, has for a long time, or Denmark. So we were sort of ramping it up from scratch and trying to introduce this. And, you know, we do have, even today, tens of millions of American jobs that are being supported. The payroll portion is being supported by the federal government through these payroll protection plan and the Small Business Administration loans and so forth. So we are doing some of that. But the evidence that we didn't execute as well as many European countries is right there in the unemployment numbers. I mean, we have allowed tens of millions of workers to become detached from their employer and to become unemployed. So the job proposal that I describe in the book is, you say, a public option, and that is exactly right. Think of it the way you would think of a public option if we had one in healthcare, where if you could not find affordable healthcare plan anywhere else from a private insurer, then there's a plan that you can walk right into, a public option, and you can have health insurance coverage through the public option. The job, the labor market option is to say to workers, if you want a job and you can't find one anywhere else in the economy, you can walk into one of the thousands of American job centers that exist all over this country, and you can walk out with a job. Okay, the federal government will fund the job. They will pay the wage and benefits for the worker, and the local communities and the people living in the local communities will help design and define the types of jobs that need to be done.
There are also many, many people who are, for whatever reason, unable to work. So what is your opinion of the universal basic income, the UBI?
You know, it's Martin Luther King Jr., for example. Many people will remember the March on Washington, either having, you know, been alive then or just knowing the history. Martin Luther King Jr., the March on Washington, was a march for jobs and justice. And what MLK said was this, and I agree with him, that people should have a right to a job if they want one. If they're seeking a job and they can't find one anywhere else, it ought to be the federal government's responsibility to ensure adequate employment for everyone who wants to work. And he said, adequate income for those, and this is how he described it, for those who cannot or should not work. I think that's right. So there are a lot of people who cannot work, but there are also a lot of people, and I know many of them, who have disabilities, but who want to work. They can work and they can do some things. Now, some people can't, and either way, there needs to be safeguards. There need to be safeguards and protection and support for incomes. But let's talk about should not work. Who should not work? That's a question, I think, for society. It's not for Stephanie Kelton to answer the question, but a universal basic income, some form of income support for, let's say, a caregiver. Okay, you're working, but the work that you do, caring for a child with a disability, caring for a loved one who's ill, a parent, let's say, you're doing that work now, probably on a volunteer basis. You leave the workforce to care for an aging parent, let's say. You're not compensated in any way for that caregiving, but you could be, and I think you should be. So we could define broadly who should fall into that category of should not work. Should a new parent work for the first 6 months or year after a child is born? Let's have that conversation. In many European countries, societies have decided the answer is no, that parents should be given time to bond with their new babies. And in some countries, the amount of time that's afforded to new parents is very generous. You have a year of paid time with that person. So that's where I am. The two can be compatible. They're certainly not inherently antagonistic to one another.
Right. It may not be a universal basic income, but what you are saying is that whether through a job or through income support, people should be able to have enough to live. Is that right?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, I do want to probably be careful, because I think that sometimes, and this is certainly not true of all supporters of UBI, but there are some who believe that, you know, capitalism is just a system that they don't want any part of, that they want the option to check out. They say, oh, this is an oppressive system. I don't want to have to participate. I don't want to have to work in order to get money. I just want money. And leave me alone, and leave me out of capitalism. That's fine until you start to think about it a little bit, and you say, "Well, give me the income so I can what? Oh, so I can pay my rent, buy my groceries, you know, put gas in my. Well, who's stocking the shelves in the grocery store, and who's, you know what I mean? A lot of people have to opt in to the economic system and agree to participate in it to allow a handful of folks to opt out. And I just believe that, you know, there's enough work to be done. God knows, with the climate crisis and everything else, we really do need all hands on deck. We're all in this together. We have more than enough work that needs to be done to keep communities safe and to protect, you know, families and people, vulnerable shoreline. And we have more than enough work to do. And I think we all ought to be willing to pitch in and do our part for the sake of humanity.
And I think we should include the artists and the writers and the theater, the actors along with it, as they did, as FDR did in the Great Depression, and as, you know, for example, France does now. They provide not a huge amount, but a subsidy to people who are also artists and intellectual workers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. We did it historically. We did it in the WPA. We supported artists and, you know, in a local community, especially in this environment. Think about where we are today. How long is it going to be before large groups of people are going back into, you know, I live in New York. So how long is it going to be before we're back on Broadway with 2,000 or 3,000 people in a room together watching a Broadway show? Those industries, clubs, comedy clubs, you know, musicians, all of that is in real danger right now. And if we can do things on a more local scale where artists and musicians and so forth can do the kinds of things they did in the WPA, you know, performances outdoors in parks, in public spaces, people can stop in and enjoy, you know, a concert, enjoy a play. You know, not only does it add great value to the community and the people living in the community, but it's going to help to save some of those, you know, to keep vibrant and alive some of those jobs through this crisis.
Absolutely. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Stephanie Kelton about her terrific new book, The Deficit Myth: Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. It totally changes the conversation about fiscal policy and how to use it to create a better society for all. So, you know, we are seeing, I think, in many ways, an unprecedentedly wide social movement for fundamental change in this country, whether that be that 70% of people are supporting, single-payer health care, a Green New Deal. You know, the people are saying we need to defund the police and fund communities. So let me ask you, do you feel that the deficit myth is weakening its hold, the myth of it weakening its hold over people? Are people beginning to question the deficit myth in a way that allows them to say another world is possible?
I think so. I mean, I do feel that it's happening, and I've been at this for more than two decades, and I've never felt this much momentum for the kind of, unleashing sort of a breakthrough in thinking, what you might call paradigm shift. And I think that it's almost impossible for people not to see it when it's also transparent now. And the reason I say that is because, 6 months ago, we were at the end of 2019, and we had just spent basically a year watching a very crowded field of Democratic presidential hopefuls debate one another over, everything from canceling student loan debt to transitioning to Medicare for all, to making public colleges and universities tuition free, childcare, you name it. We had, a large number of people running for president saying, we can do this and we can do that, we could do this, and I want to do this. And at every turn, they were dogged by a single question: how are you going to pay for it? Where's the money going to come from? And then we got all bogged down in whether, it was too expensive, whether we could really afford these things, whether, this tax increase or that tax increase would raise enough revenue. Was it all pie in the sky? Could we ever really have any of this? And now here we are, 6 months later, watching Congress spin out trillion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar spending bills without a moment's pause. No one debated whose taxes needed to go up. No one said, how are we going to pay for it? They just did it. And I think that has really shined a light on how things work. It has allowed people to go, what in the world were we thinking last year when we were, trapped in this framework that had us all wondering how we could possibly, achieve anything. And here we are, and Congress is committing funding to all sorts of legislation to support the economy. So, we don't have any new fiscal capacity that we didn't have last year. Congress has the same fiscal fortitude that it had last year. So what has changed? The answer is the commitment that Congress has become committed to doing something. The sense of urgency is there. It's a priority. And when Congress prioritizes something and gives it a sense of urgency, they can fund it very easily. It's just that they didn't consider our crumbling infrastructure a priority. They didn't consider 87 million Americans with inadequate health insurance coverage a priority. They didn't consider 40 million Americans living in poverty a priority. They didn't consider 500,000 people sleeping out on the street every night a priority, and on and on and on. So, yeah, I feel like things are changing.
But of course, now the question is, who is getting those trillions of dollars? Because it still is not the people who are sleeping out on the street, or the people who are going to be sleeping out on the street because they can't afford their rent anymore, or the people who have lost their health insurance. So what do you say about the choices we make with the fiscal, Congress's fiscal power of the purse?
Well, I think that obviously that's the critical question, because as I say all the time, every deficit is good for someone. The question is, for whom and for what are these deficits being run? So, right now, we might not like everything about the CARES Act or, the lending facilities and what, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, has done to give the Federal Reserve some expanded authority to lend to support different businesses and so forth. We can complain about who's getting, what and how much. But it is definitely the case that, you know, a non-trivial amount of support is going to people who are the most vulnerable. I mean, we expanded unemployment insurance to cover gig workers and people who wouldn't have previously qualified for unemployment insurance. And not only that, Congress topped up the amount of unemployment compensation they would receive at the state level, adding another $600 a week to unemployment insurance. So we do have people today who are receiving unemployment benefits, who are for the first time in their working lives making enough money, unemployed, to pay all of their bills. They say, I've never been in this situation before. Before I was working and scraping by, and I still didn't have enough money. I had to borrow at the end of the month. Now, for the first time, right, I have enough money. And guess what? It's expiring at the end of July. If Congress doesn't act, there is an income cliff coming up that's going to leave tens of millions of Americans facing, like you said, eviction. I can't pay my rent this month. So, you know, we need to continue the support. We need to work harder to get the dollars to go to the people who are most in need, where they can do the most good, and to avoid as much as possible providing support for people who don't need it.
Well, Stephanie Kelton, this has just been such an interesting conversation. I mean, your book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory, and the Birth of the People's Economy, is really, its time has come. It was probably always here, but now more than ever. And thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stephanie Kelton is a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University. She's a leading expert on modern monetary theory and a former chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee, the Democratic staff. She was named by Politico as one of the 50 people most influencing the policy debate in America. Go to writersvoice.net to read some articles by Stephanie Kelton. And now on to some great summer reading picks. If you want some smartly written distraction fiction, I've got two books to recommend. In the crime fiction field is Heather Young's The Distant Dead. It's about the murder of a middle school teacher in a small western town. The characters are flawlessly drawn. The writing is taut and descriptive. The plot is satisfyingly twisty and compelling. The Distant Dead is just as good as Heather Young's first novel, The Lost Girls. Read them both for a treat. Then there's Dean Koontz's penultimate new book, Devoted. It features a super intelligent dog, a plot to transform humanity that goes very wrong, and a heroic young boy on the autism spectrum. I don't usually read fantasy or horror thrillers like this one, but Devoted is a really fun read with some wonderful writing. It's kind of a morality fable that plumbs the depths of human depravity to remind us of the heights of the human spirit. Well, it looks like we've got some time left on the show. Just enough time to read some poems by my good friend Meg Fisher, who is a wonderful poet. Something I didn't know quite as much as I do now, since a couple of weeks ago she sent me a few poems. Here is Rope of Sorrow. I wring the water lukewarm from the washcloths so often that water and bucket and cloth and hands become one rope of sorrow, tying me to task, while all around me, just out of reach, spins a sun-filled birch light, sweet, sweet, sweet. And I see in that moment that I give my whole attention to sorrow, not to joy. What is this doting that I do on sorrow by life's open window? Come, what's here is here, and given is what is. How strong my hands are in this service. How alive my heart. That is Rope of Sorrow by Meg Fisher. Here's another poem by Meg Fisher. It's called Another Mother. And in the first line, she is quoting Mary Oliver, who is both one of her favorite poets and mine. This is the poem Another Mother by Meg Fisher. Needing one, I invented her. Another mother, ample, apple red, who joyful in her kitchen bellied up to stove and licked her fingers, stirred the pot with tasting spoon, and did not measure cinnamon or bay or thyme, who'd laugh easy as breathing or fall still as stone when I told what it was that I'd felt there as the honey locusts tossed in morning rain and cold outside my bedroom window, warm under my flannel sheet. And in the night she'd hold me, or she'd put a hand upon my cheek that told me dearly I was dear as my own hand was, being hers. It was a revelation. Was I 9 or 10? That someone so unreal could be, in fact, somehow most real and soothe me just as well. By day, without a prayer, I'd search in other kitchens for her, somehow sure there was a where she'd be. That was a poem, Another Mother, by Meg Fisher of Western Massachusetts. And finally, a poem that I have posted on the Writer's Voice website on the page devoted to the interview that I did with Sue Monk Kidd about her latest book about the imagined wife of Jesus. It's called The Book of Longings. And then a few weeks later, Meg sent me this poem, which is about Mary Magdalene. So I will read that now. Mary Magdalene. So I was drawn to him, as were so many. I stood out from the rest for being woman, but we all wore robes and sandals, so I blended in. It was the stories he could tell, the way they lived in him, the way he tossed them to the crowd like silver fish, to multitudes, or even just to 2 or 3. I had stories of my own, we all did. Sometimes when he was tired, he'd listen to the rest of us around the fire or on the road. I felt the trouble brewing as that band of his increased, first 1, then 2 more, another, didn't stop till there were 12, and how they left their wives, their parents, friends, how all our heads were turned. I could have warned him, did in fact. But there's no warning someone who's so bitten by the truth. And so, like the others, I lived in his presence when I did, and in his absence the rest of the time, caring for my father, mending thatch and fetching water from the well, grapes from the vineyard, bringing our family loaf to the common oven, chatting there with friends who'd tease me, "You're preoccupied these days." Oh, I was occupied all right. And still am, and will be. This rare sap, radical sweetness, lifts my arms, fills these my hands. And that is the poem Mary Magdalene by Meg Fisher. The poems of Meg Fisher's that I've read today are Rope of Sorrow, Another Mother, and Mary Magdalene. Thank you, Meg, for sending them to me. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.